नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ओम 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 नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय.
Canto 1, Chapter 4, text numbers 14 through 18. We finished the section where Shaunaka is asking the questions that make up the whole, the answers to which make up the whole rest of the first canto, practically. And now Sutta is just beginning to speak. Questions were in relation to the appearance of Srimad Bhagavatam to Shukadeva Goswami, the qualified speaker of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and Maharaj Pariksit, the qualified receiver. So the focus now is now going to how the Bhagavatam made its appearance. Sutta Goswami said, when the second millennium overlapped the third, the great sage Vyasadeva was born to Parashara in the womb of Satyavati, the daughter of Vasu. Overlapping of millenniums. Prabhupada uses this word millennium. The Sanskrit is Dvapare, in the second millennium, and Tritiya Yuga. So the Yuga, he uses millenniums in different ways at different times. The overlapping of yugas. Anybody here an astrology fan? So, the way that time is calculated is that there are, how I think of it is like an expansion bridge. There's a bridge, and knowing that in the summer everything expands in the heat, in the winter everything contracts in the cold, they make little sections where there's like teeth that fit together and it can combine and then it can recede, but it still doesn't lose its connection altogether. So, something like that. There are periods of time that there's an overlap. And the overlap can become more or less. And there's certain rules where there's a certain overlap, but if an overlap happens in such and such and such and such way, then they switch positions. Something like that. So, one of those happened in the 28th yuga cycle of Vaivasvatamanu. In the 28th yuga cycle, Prabhupada writes in the purport, the chronological order of the four millenniums is Satya, Dwarapa, Treta, and Kali. But in the 28th cycle of yugas, during the reign of Vaivasvatamanu, there was an overlapping such that Dwarapa Yuga, instead of being in the number 2 position, went to the number 3 position, and Treta Yuga, instead of being in the 3rd position, went to the 2nd position. during that, it's a technical point, but just so for sake of reference, during that 28th yuga cycle of Vaivasvata Manu, that's when Vyasa appeared. It just happened to be the same time as when Suta Goswami is speaking, but Vyasa was born of Parashara Muni in the womb of Satyavati, the daughter of Vasu. So we'll spend a little bit of time discussing that interesting event. That led to other interesting events. Vasu was a fisherman, and he had a daughter, Satyavati. So he made the recommendation to his daughter that why don't you take the service of conducting boats across the river? There may be, by good fortune, one sadhu will want to cross the river, and if you could do some service for a sadhu, that would be great fortune for you. And maybe that sadhu will give you some blessing. That would be even greater fortune for you. So under the indication of her father, she took the profession of taking boats across the river. So one time, Parashara Muni was crossing the river, and he got in Satyavati's boat. And being very expert in Vedic astronomy, he was making an astronomical calculation. And as he was doing his calculations, he came to understand that an incarnation of the Lord would soon appear. In fact, at that very juncture of time and at that very location where he was, right in the middle of the river. So he made a request of Satyavati that she become the father of an incarnation of the Lord. And Satyavati was embarrassed and said, well, how can that be? He said, I'll be the father and you'll be the mother. And she said, but how will that work? I understand you're a sadhu and everything, but we're not even married. And he said, don't worry. Your virginity will be maintained intact. Please accept my request. This is very important. Time is running out. And she said, but how will this work? Even if somehow pregnancy can happen, but my virginity is not lost, how will it work with 9 months of pregnancy? And everyone's going to ask, hey, Satyavati, what happened? And Parashara Muni said, don't worry. The child will be born shortly after conception. The child will grow to a full maturity shortly after conception. Don't worry. And she said, well, we're in our boat right in the middle of the river, and there's people on both sides of the river. And he said, don't worry. By mystic power, I'll create an island. And the island will be invisible to anybody else but yourself and myself. And in this way, you can conceive an incarnation of the Supreme Lord. Satyavati, all of her excuses or reasons why it wouldn't work were gone, answered by Vyas. And so she agreed. He created a mystical island, therefore his name is Krishna Dvaipayana, as in the Dvipa, born on the island created by Parashara Muni. And it was an incarnation of Krishna, so Krishna Dvaipayana Vyas. Because in each of the cycle of four yugas, just prior to Dwarpa Yuga, there's another Vyas. It's a function. It's a post. And someone fills the post. This time, the post was filled by Krishna Dvaipayana Vyas. And so, Vyas was conceived by Parashar Muni, and the child was born, and the child manifested as a fully matured adult. Same thing happened with, it doesn't describe the technology at all, but same thing happened with Brahma and the first Manu, Swayambhuva Manu, and his wife Shatarupa were born as mature adults. Same thing happened with Shukadeva Goswami, 16 years old. No explanation of technology, but somehow by mystical power, that happened. Vyas was born. Of Satyavati. And there were some benedictions given to Satyavati. Satyavati was given three benedictions. One was that her features would be beautiful, because previously it wasn't as beautiful as after the benediction. This, and another was that although she was the daughter of a fisherman, and so ordinarily her body would be smelling of a fishy smell, it was of a most heavenly fragrance. And anyone who smelled the fragrance of the body of Satyavati would become very attracted, which worked later for Maharaj Santanu. And Vyasadeva gave a benediction to Satyavati, and that was that if at any time she needed service from him, she just needed to call his name and instantly he would be there. And with that, he left. Same as Shukadeva Goswami. After Shukadeva Goswami was born, he left immediately. So, Satyavati, imagine what her experience was like, having gone through that one. She went back and told everything to her father. Oh, there was another benediction, that her son would become a king. So, Vasa was very happy. When his daughter came back home, oh, you look so beautiful, and your fragrance, it's not this fishy smell. Oh, that's because let me tell you what happened. So, her father was very convinced that by the blessing of Parashara Muni, that her daughter, his daughter, would become a queen. And her son would become, in turn, would become king. That was the benediction of sages that would never fail. So he was fully convinced. And more to follow from Mahabharata with Santanu, who became attracted to Satyavati. So, the mention here is that Vyasadeva was born during the Dwarpa Yuga, that was normally in the second position, but this time was in the third position. He was born in Dwarpa Yuga as the son of Satyavati and Parashara Muni. Okay, back to the text. Once upon a time, he, Vyasadeva, as the sun rose, took morning ablution in the waters of the Saraswati and sat alone to concentrate. The short purport Prabhupada describes that this river Saraswati, the particular part of the river Saraswati, is at Badrikashram, where Vyasadeva was and still is. Samya Prasa in Badrikashram. So Vyasadeva has a number of very special qualifications. One of them is he's a Chiran jiva, he lives for, he spans over many ages, which is very good because it's such a, it's Vyasadeva along with Nara Narayan Rishi and other great sages who are inaccessible for ordinary persons. Madhvacharya was able to access, but their residence is in a higher dimensional region. This is what's described in the biographies of Madhvacharya. There are five levels of Badrinath or Badrikashram, and Vyasadeva is in the highest level, and the place that's described in the biographies of Madhvacharya, it's beyond heavenly. It's amazing. It's like springtime eternally. It's like the descriptions of Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan, although there's multiple seasons in Vrindavan. During Krishna's time, every season was like spring. Spring's a very nice season. So, Vyasadeva's ashram is like that also. And he is residing there, and when Kali Yuga is finished, Kalki Avatar comes and does his thing, annihilates and delivers everybody, so the slate is clean, the planet is without demoniac population. Vyas descends along with others, and they then begin Satyuga. That's how it works. So you get from the bottom of the worst yuga, all of a sudden you go to the topmost yuga, and it starts going down again. Because that's what time does, and the modes of nature do. So that's where Vyas was, and he was performing his morning duties. And although he's a perfectly liberated sage, little important point, but he nonetheless was performing his daily duties, not because he needed to perform them for liberation, but he was just doing them out of his quality of purity. It was spontaneous. And while he was performing those morning duties, he saw anomalies in the duties of the millennium, that's the coming Kali Yuga. This happens on the earth in different ages due to unforeseen forces in the course of time. So, Prabhupada's comment is that by different methods, different persons can see things in the future. If one is very, very expert in astrology, one can literally see things. Just like in Chaitanya Bhagavat, there's a description of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu making visits to different shops in Navadvip. He would go to the cloth merchant and ask for cloth and so on and so on. The fruit merchant and ask for fruits. And so one time he went to the astrologer's shop, sat down, looked at the astrologer and said, "My dear astrologer, could you tell me who I was in my last life?" And the astrologer said, "Certainly." So he said his mantras, Gopal mantras, and went into a deep meditation, and in his meditation he saw Lord Vamana, Lord Krishna, Lord Nrsingadeva. One after in detail describing the forms, and the astrologer was startled. He opened his eyes and looked at Mahaprabhu, who was smiling, and said, "My dear astrologer, have you determined yet who I was in my previous life?" And the astrologer said, "I think I need to do some more meditation. Can I come back this afternoon?" So some astrologers use that method also. It's actually, it's not just a set of rules and you put the rules together and it's all mathematical and literally mechanical. It's not just, it's mathematical and mechanical, but there's a subtle science or the inspiration from super soul factor that one actually has to be pure. And when one is actually pure, as was Vyas, then you can see things, literally see things, not just predict things. So Vyas had that capacity. And he could see that the symptoms of the age of Kali were frightening, especially for someone who's a sage. In the purport, Prabhupada is describing, characterizing, that the essence of that deterioration is too much interest in matter, very simply expressed. And that's an ignorance that then covers the consciousness of the soul, and in that covered consciousness of the soul, all other bad things come out that are just symptoms of covered consciousness or too much affinity for matter. The text 17 and 18, the translation reads, "The great sage," that's Vyas, "who was fully equipped in knowledge, could see through his transcendental vision the deterioration of everything material." There are three things mentioned. Deterioration of everything material due to the influence of the age. Second mention is, he could see that the faithless people in general would be reduced in duration of life. Well, everyone is faithless. It's not that they're faithful and they had the same duration of life as the previous age. All are faithless and the duration of life is shortened. And another is that people would be impatient due to lack of goodness. Thus, he contemplated for the welfare of men in all statuses and orders of life. So one by one, Prabhupada goes through these three qualities that he saw as symptoms. All are subsets of too much affinity for matter. So the first one, Prabhupada writes in the purport, "The power of all material objects deteriorates by the influence of time." Did you know that material objects have power? How is it that material objects have power? It's like, say, herbs have some potency, or gems have some potency, or it's just matter. But there's some potency, and the potency is through touch of spirit. So if spiritual consciousness becomes weakened, then the potency of all things becomes weakened. The potency of food, potency of whatever there is. You know, the strength of men. We think we're getting really strong. People, you know, lift weights and do stuff. But consider, you know, whole forests were removed, and just say in this country, just a few generations ago, by people. All they had, they didn't have tractors and big cranes and all those things. They just had themselves and some horses and mules. And, you know, whole forests were removed, and, you know, big rocks, and they didn't have big equipment. They were very strong, very hearty. So here's some examples that Prabhupada gives of the potency of matter being reduced. The duration of life is one. Memory is another. He writes, the action of matter has also not so much incentive. Doesn't explain it. The action of matter has also not so much incentive. The land does not produce food grains in the same proportions as it did in other ages. The cow does not give as much milk as it used to formerly. And aside from duration of life, there's diseases. Prabhupada, in the further down the purport, speaks about tuberculosis. Previously, there was no such thing as tuberculosis. Now there's tuberculosis, and there's tuberculosis hospitals, and so on. It's Kali Yuga. AIDS, where was that one before? And now it's a big problem. So the physical strength and resistance to disease is diminished compared to, maybe not compared to, you know, medieval times or whatever, as far as a European perspective of history and medicine and so on. But where there's very strong spiritual consciousness, it makes the body strong. That's to say, you know, strong in ways that you can't, we don't have the capacity presently. No capacity for fasting, capacity for austerities. People are wimps, they can't do these things anymore. Meditation, not like previous ages. It's because of the weakened condition of spiritual consciousness of the soul. Or, say it the other way, affinity for matter, which means that the darkness of ignorance covers the normal or natural consciousness of the soul, and so with that dim consciousness, spiritual strength is less, and the strength of matter is less, matter that the soul is in contact with and covered by. From that understanding, Prabhupada goes to the next idea, another paragraph, where Vyas, because of his spiritual strength, he could see things that other people couldn't see. He could see the future. Prabhupada writes, as an astrologer can see the future of a man, or as an astronomer can foretell the solar and lunar eclipses, liberated souls who can see through the scriptures can foretell the future of all mankind. They can see this due to their sharp vision of spiritual attainment. That's something that Vyas had, and Vyas could see in this age there's such a deterioration of spiritual strength, and therefore also the strength of even matter. Second point that's mentioned is faithlessness. Faith would diminish. Duration of life would also diminish. And impatient due to lack of goodness. Prabhupada writes, the unfortunate men of this age are always reluctant to give a reception to the transcendentalists or representatives of Srila Vyasadeva, and selfless workers always busy in planning something which may help everyone in all statuses and orders of life. In other words, they're not just armchair savants, persons who can see things and know things, and they just pronounce, okay, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. But they're very actively involved in trying to remedy the problem, or trying to awaken dormant consciousness specifically. Just this morning, I sent out the little Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur Singh. One of the last lecture that he gave in his life, because after he spoke last, he was bedridden and then gave up his body. He spoke about, during my life, I have said many things that may have caused people pain and hurt. But please understand that in so doing, my intention was only one thing, to withdraw their attention from matter and bring their attention once again to the Supreme Lord, because by so doing, they could achieve the real purpose of this human form of life, and the mission of life would be completed, and they would go back to Godhead. I would simply pray that someday they will understand that was my intent. So he had his style, or his particular approach, but the principle of Vyasadeva, what he's about to do, or anyone representing Vyasadeva, however their style or approach might be, it's the focus is one thing. Prabhupada writes, the greatest philanthropists are those transcendentalists who represent the mission of Vyas, Narada, Madhva, Chaitanya, Rupa, Saraswati, etc. They are one and the same. The personalities may be different, but the aim of the mission is one and the same, namely, to deliver the fallen souls back home, back to Godhead. Which Prabhupada himself was doing, the monumental task of translating Srimad Bhagavatam, that alone. Huge. Well, what was the task was huge, and what was the purpose behind it? Taking the attention of conditioned souls away from matter and placing it upon the Supreme, and thereby delivering them from the deteriorating, depleting, embarrassing conditions of the age of Kali. I was thinking to spend a little bit of time this morning based upon this verse, and also based upon our discussion yesterday. The anishtata, moving to nishta bhakti topics that came up yesterday. And discussing a little bit about this phrase that is in the verse, one of the symptoms that Vyas saw before it happened was impatience due to lack of goodness. And how that can make havoc in trying to advance in Krishna consciousness. We know from Bhagavad Gita that the mode of goodness is mixed with the other modes. That's the way of this world. There's nothing in this material world is pure. Even ignorance isn't pure. But it's mixed. The modes of nature are in constant competition with one another, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. So if one mode of nature is prominent, the other two are still there, they're also competing for supremacy, and then that another mode will become prominent, the other two will become recessive, and another mode will become prominent, and over all there may be a more prominent mode or combination of modes for a particular person. But even a bad person can be good, and a good person can be bad, for example, because the modes are competing for supremacy. However, overall, when Krishna consciousness is being properly practiced, we know this from chapter 2 of the first canto, when devotional service is being properly practiced, what happens with the modes of nature? Rajo tamo, the modes of ignorance and passion diminish. What's the beginning of that verse? 1, 2.
Tadarajas.
Thank you. Tadarajas tamo bhava kama lobhada yasye. Cheta etar anad vidham stitvam sattve prasidati. So, to the execution of devotional service, the mode of goodness becomes more prominent because the other modes are reduced. Tada. Rajas tamo bhava. Raja and tama are diminished by the influence of devotion. Stittvam sattve prasidati. One becomes situated in goodness. Due to the absence of goodness, due to the absence of devotional service, there's the absence of goodness or depletion of goodness, and passionate ignorance become more prominent. And it's not just devotional service, but it's devotional service with the right consciousness, the right goal, and to keep oneself fixed upon the goal, one has to have the right mood of being the servant, just like the discussion yesterday, the relationships discussion. The acceptance of God as the object, immediately we're the subject, just like the expression, the common expression is the king and his subjects. The king and his subjects. So Krishna is he's the king of kings, and we're subjects. What does a subject do in relation to the king, or the, if we're the subject, Krishna is the object. It's the relationship is service, and that should be the mood. The mood should be happily serving, because he's the master. Prabhupada once said, Krishna consciousness is very simple. God is very great, and I am very small, therefore I should serve him. That is Krishna consciousness. So, how great is God makes it very clear how small I am. But it's not like, oh, now I'm depressed because I'm small. It's, I'm a servant of the great. I'm very happy being the servant of the great. I'm happy as anything because he's so great and I get a chance to serve him even though I'm so insignificant. But he's, one of his greatnesses is he's very merciful and he accepts service from little puny beings like me because he's so merciful. So the mood of service when we're rendering devotional service, not the masters, but the servants of the Supreme, then the mode of goodness becomes more prominent. The mode of ignorance and passion becomes less. And then we can have our relationships with one another in Krishna consciousness. But if we don't have that mood of service unto Krishna, you know, have it in focus, and in turn the best way to serve Krishna, this is one of the essential teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as well of Ramanujacharya. In Navadvip Dham Mahatmya, which is a book written by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. It's a description of the visit to the places of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pastimes in Navadvip, conducted by Lord Nityananda, as he was taking Jiva Goswami to all the places of Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. In one of those places they visited, Jiva Goswami is described by Lord Nityananda that Nimbarkacharya was on pilgrimage to Navadvip, and he found it so attractive. He sat and performed his bhajan there for some time, and Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared before him and told him, in a future set of generations, I am going to come into this world and show my form like this. And the specific teachings which you are giving will be such and such and such and such, and I will incorporate those in my teachings. And he described each of the sampradayas. So, from the Sri Sampradaya of Ramanujacharya's teachings, that which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said that he would incorporate within his teachings, thus, in other words, unifying the four sampradayas, was service to the Vaishnavas and the understanding that bhakti is devoid of karma and gyan, or shuddha bhakti, without fruitive intention or speculative knowledge, eschewing or giving up those two as the standard of devotional service. And isn't that what Rupa Goswami has taught in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu? Anyabhilasha shunyam jnana karmatya navratam. That understanding is not just like that's a Ramanujacharya special. It's scriptural. It's a teaching of the scripture, again and again taught, which Ramanujacharya emphasized and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu emphasized as components of Shuddha Bhakti. But serving of the Vaishnavas is also, you know, our classic example that we hear in ISKCON over and over again is that in the Adi Purana, there's also dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, just like in Bhagavad Gita. And in Adi Purana, Krishna says to Arjuna, one who claims to be my devotee is not my devotee. And one who is the devotee of my devotee, that's my devotee. Or Lord Chaitanya's teaching is the servant of the servant of the servant of the servant of the gopis who are intimately serving Krishna. That's the devotee. More times removed, better. Servant of the servant. So, serving the devotees is a cornerstone, a fundamental core teaching of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Why? Because we don't have the qualification to approach Krishna directly. Moreover, our purpose is to please Krishna, and Krishna is pleased when we approach those who are dear to him and we serve those who are dear to him, and so by so doing we're serving Krishna. And if the motive passion is very strong, we don't serve others, we compete with others. I just was writing to a group of teenagers, some girls that are 13, picture in your mind, some. They're in different places, so they don't have a teenager their age to associate with, so I've arranged that they read together. You know, they're in different parts of the country. They just don't have anyone their age, and they have to have a friend. They don't have anybody their age. So there are some others their age, and they're really nice devotees. So they're reading together. Two of them just wrote to me saying, "Oh, I really like, I'm able to associate with somebody my age and make sure that it's Krishna, not just hang out together, but Krishna conscious association." So they finished really reading the Lamrita, and now they're beginning Nectar of Instruction. And they really like the time they spend, and that they're able to share realizations with one another. Two of them are, they're 13-year-old girls, and they're chanting 14 rounds a day, and they're straight-A students. Another one is also a straight-A student, but she doesn't have the same firmness in her chanting. So I just this morning was writing to her saying, your chanting shouldn't be, you know, I try to squeeze in some rounds after I come home from school. It should be, it's a very fixed thing. And your whole life, for your whole life, fix it now, for your whole life. And consider these other two that you're very much appreciating their association, because they're really special kids. But, you know, try to fix your chanting, not so that you're competing with them. Oh, they're chanting these many, I have to chant at least these many, if not more. Because that's the material way of how we do things. They're getting, you know, this grade in their exam, I should get that grade in the exam. Because we're trained in competition. Competition is, it just kills the spirit of service. It's just the opposite of service. So, in your anishtita bhakti stage, don't let the spirit of competition come in into the arena, the realm of Vaishnav Sangha. Let this higher principle, the mode of goodness principle, what to speak of transcendental principle, of serving the Vaishnavas. Just serving, because that's who we are, we're servants. The discussion yesterday, your question about, we're just, because that's who we are. So we serve others. And especially we serve the devotees, because the devotees are carrying Krishna Bhakti. However much Krishna Bhakti, they're carrying Krishna Bhakti in their hearts, and we value that. That's very special. So we value that. And serve that person. Why? Because they're carrying Krishna Bhakti in their heart. However they may be, like me, you know, flawed and with shortcomings and not there yet and whatever else. They make mistakes. Something. But serve, because there's Krishna Bhakti. And Krishna will be pleased if, and when Krishna is pleased, that's my happiness. At least that's what I want my life to be. My happiness is the happiness of the beloved. My beloved is Krishna. I'm not there yet, but I want to cultivate that. So one of the means for cultivating that is the association of devotees. See it the other way around. Try cultivating Krishna consciousness off in a forest. Or, you know, move to some place where there's no devotee association. It's tough. I know some people that are in that situation, and it's tough. It's really tough. Tough, tough. Then come into the association and start taking that association for granted, and start, familiarity breeds contempt, and being contemptuous with one another. That's worse than tough. So, stitvam satve prasidati. Mode of goodness is a simple element of goodness, is respecting other living beings. I mean, even if you can't see that they're spirit soul, even if you can't see that they're carrying Krishna bhakti, just respect, because they're living beings. And then take it up some notches if, according to one's realization. And that will help enormously in your cultivation of Krishna consciousness at this stage. Now, at higher stages, then it's, you know, it's even more spontaneous and natural and totally blissful. The absence of that is the influence of Kali, which what Vyasadeva was seeing. The higher qualities of the soul were covered by ignorance in the age of Kali, and so he considered what to do. That's what's coming up, the coming attractions. It's Vyasadeva is now going to set himself to, because his thing, his gift, is he's a literary person. So he's going to write some literature that will assist those living entities that are struggling hard with the modes of nature and the age of Kali to elevate themselves. And then eventually the Bhagavatam manifests. To be continued. Any discussion?
Maharaj, in any sangha of devotees, either because of different devotees being in different phase of life, or just because they have different personalities, when different devotees hear the same talk being given, there are certain different points that stand out to them. Basically,
natural.
On
that's,
what,
that's natural.
Whatever their orientation is, or
sure.
Something.
That's completely natural.
Maharaj, my question is: now, when we are in a particular sangha of devotees, and most of them have a specific, in some sense, mood, and there is some other aspect that we are focusing on, which is not the same. They are, in some sense, they are.
It's called respecting differences.
Right.
That's the resolution of. It's not a dilemma at all. It's respecting differences. And if you don't have respect, then you're not respecting differences. It's you're different, and it becomes judgmental. Respect differences.
Maharaj, my question is, how do we internally adjust to the differences in the sense that...
Respect. That's the answer. Respect. Is that a problem? Or I'm not answering your question?
My question is more along the lines of we start questioning our own understanding. In that sense, because most of them have this other mood, and we have this other mood. Both are not, they're not quite wrong in any sense. They are just emphasizing different aspects of it. So, if you continue going in that particular sangha, and we see this particular mood, then we start questioning our own understanding of whatever we think we need to focus on. And in that case, then you're always doubting, am I getting this right? Am I getting this wrong? So then, how to be, in some sense, you know, comfortable with your understanding and just acting on that? Is the solution going in a sangha which aligns with your way of thinking? Or, I'm confused about it, Maharaj, so I just wanted to put that question.
Okay, I think I already answered it. If the scenario, I don't need to repeat because you did it three times, so the scenario is clear. Mm-hmm. How strong is my respect muscle? Maybe it not be so strong, but at least I can exercise it a little bit. That's enough. And then. So, as much as there is respect, then different moods are fine. It's fine. It's wonderful. Provided there's respect. But what if I don't have capacity for respect? It just hasn't developed in me yet. I know it's there potentially, but it's just not developed yet. So I need to, you know, do a little, you know, respect therapy. Like physical, just do a little exercise, just exercise that respect muscle a bit. When that's there, then one need not question one's own, you know, as you said, mood, unless there's something dysfunctional or out of line with a Vaishnava mood. So then we have persons that we can turn to who are senior to us and do a little reality check. And if the reality check says you're right on the mark, the reality check may say you're, you know, 90% on the mark, and that 10% needs some attention. May say, you know, well, 50% you're on the mark. Or you're almost off the road. Well, watch out. Look out for the ditch. Then there should be responsiveness to that feedback. But if there's... I like very much the saying, because it's true, charity begins at home. So there may be some need to look inside and say, you know, that's wholesome. You know, because I've done some reality checks here. And that's wholesome, and I'm quite contented. Let's just go a little bit off the topic, a little bit of the frame that you're bringing, and go into kirtan. Some persons like kirtan this way. Some persons, it's a different style, different mood. And somebody likes this mood. And somebody likes that mood. Somebody likes, you know, any mood, anything as long as the holy name. That's fine with anything as long as the holy name. But then, you know, there may be, even within a given style of someone's care time, if there's, the style may be fine provided the consciousness is pure. And there may be a fine style where the consciousness is not pure. And that part, maybe somebody has some discomfort with. Purity is another dimension, is what I mean to say here. Okay, move on. Yes.
Thank you very much for this nice class. I have actually two questions.
Okay.
One was the first one when you told, like, the influence of Kali, the deterioration of the power of material things. But this is like something which I heard, like, in India right now the power of TV is increasing so much.
The power of
TV, television.
Television.
Yeah. So how is it? I thought it was the most material thing.
Okay. What Prabhupada was, he gave examples of what he meant. Land is producing less, and so forth. That, in that sense, material objects have less strength. Duration of life is shorter. The other examples I gave, herbs are not as potent, so on. That, definitely, television and other forms of technology have really grabbed a hold and thrown the consciousness of people into the trash can, put the lid on. Very powerful. Second question.
Second question is with respect to the, like the example of the 13-year-old you were saying.
Yeah.
The thing was, so in this case, like if when this person, when this one person, or talking in my sense, so how does spiritual competition work when we are looking with respect to spiritual progress? Like, do you...
Here's how it works. Krishna is the object. And if Krishna is pleased, that's very nice. So who can please Krishna the most? That's spiritual competition. Prabhupada gives the example of the gopis. They're not competing against one another. When one gopi is able to please Krishna, the other gopis become very happy, thinking, let me also try to please Krishna very much. And then the first gopi become very happy. Now gopi number two has managed to please Krishna very much. And gopi number three is thinking, oh, this is very nice. Krishna's pleased. Let me try to also increase Krishna's happiness, and she does better than number one and number two, and number one and number two are very happy. That's spiritual competition. Material competition is pull somebody down, and that pushes me up. It doesn't push one up, it pulls one down, the mentality of enviousness. That's the spirit of material competition. And kids and us bigger kids have learned competition. It's a sure way to get kids fired up. Have them compete. They get really fired up. But it's feeding, you know, the wrong mode of nature, the mode of passion. And you know, the soul and Krishna get eclipsed. It's all about winning and defeating and putting the other one down, being victorious. It's far more challenging to inspire spiritual competition. Who can, let's see how Krishna can be pleased the most. That's wonderful. Anything else? Yes.
About faith, one of the symptoms of Kali is lack of faith. So in this connection, I want to ask that when personally itself, when we do our devotional service, we see that we do so many mistakes and everything, but then there is this center, like you showed yesterday in the talk, that there is this God in the center and there's a spiritual guide, but we don't see God, but we can see somebody else who's like exemplary, and we have faith. But my concern is that Maya can any time hit me and make my faith in that person disturbed, right? So every time I make a mistake, or if there is anything low, there is something at the background which is helping me out, but I'm concerned that this faith might someday diminish.
Yeah, it's good to have that concern. Because it's true, it can happen at any time. So, what the remedy is, maturing in faith. And until one's faith is matured, at any time, in the beginning stage, faith is soft and pliable, according to the Goswami. Something can come and, well, next thing you know, it just disappeared. So it's a risky territory or stage to be passing through. Therefore, one should be on guard, which is the spirit of your question, and also qualitatively perform the activities of bhakti, especially hearing and chanting, or receiving messages, transcendental knowledge, and proper chanting of the holy name. Prabhupada writes in Bhagavad Gita, faith is created, or it's increased, it's nurtured through the association of devotees. But then we should be very careful associating with devotees we don't make offense. Unfortunately, I haven't given you the promise that that will never happen, because it's not true. That can happen. So we should be careful. And grow in your Krishna consciousness in the proper means. And take shelter of Krishna, that he'll protect you from that happening. Although still it can happen.
Yes, Maharaj, but the question is not fair, because...
Not fair?
I mean...
Come on! Who makes the rules? You make the rules, or someone else does.
Krishna's watching us, right? So you can.
Yeah, Krishna's watching. So Krishna's hand isn't. You know, it's not that.
It's like a child saying, "It's not fair. I have a walking propensity, and why shouldn't I just be able to walk without picking up and falling down? It's not fair." Just keep walking. Keep trying to walk, and the walking propensity comes out. That's how it works. And you know, whining about it's not fair, just keep walking. Little baby will learn to walk. Just keep walking. It's propensity. Propensity for love, of love for Krishna is there. Just keep on that path. By prescribed means. And if you take a spill, Krishna will pick you up, just like a loving parent. The child was watching a mother yesterday, teaching her little child to walk, and holding his little hands, and he took, you know, a step, and another step, and tumbled. But, you know, she was there, she picked him up. And walking propensity was coming out, and he wasn't saying, "You're, hey, it's not fair." Something else? Yes.
Can you please tell us something about patience?
Patience.
Importance of patience.
Uh huh. Especially this young lady over here. Talking about patience. Okay. Thank you for asking that question. I'll say two simple things. That the foundation of patience is a spiritual conception, that's one. And second is confidence in Krishna, or the process of bhakti which brings one to Krishna. If I have confidence in Krishna and the process that takes me to him, and there's a spiritual conception, I can be patient. And not become complacent, still be very enthusiastic, but the outcome is on Krishna's time. I'm not going to, you know, determine Krishna's time. Krishna's going to determine Krishna's time. Or say it differently, Krishna's terms. I'm fine. Krishna sets the rules, and it's on his time. My one interest is, let me just stay in this relationship with Krishna because I trust him. And there's a spiritual conception of what that means, and it's fine. Whatever that means. A practical application of the very same thing is a little something that I had forgotten, but I recently remembered it. When I was a small boy, we had a house with a big backyard, and my father was into gardening. And one time he got the idea of, the whole family would go together at different times. We'd pick blueberries during blueberry season. We did things like that. So my father decided he wanted to get a peach tree, so he planted a peach tree. I remember as a small boy looking up at the peach tree and looking like, when are the peaches coming? And I'd go ask my mother, when are the peaches coming? I said, be patient. It's just a young tree. It doesn't deliver peaches right away. Then after couple of years, the little green, hard fruits would come and, Mom, this is, what kind of peaches are this? I said, be patient. In a few years, it'll produce nice, juicy fruit. Just have to be patient. And, the main thing goes to nurturing that which you want to grow and by nature's arrangement in time. In God's own time. You can't just stamp our little feet and say, I want that peach tree to make peaches right away. It's not fair. it's trust in the process and sustained by a spiritual conception. Then I can go on very enthusiastically and at the same time be patient. Yes?
Just talking about mixed modes, you're talking about mixed modes, that none of the modes are actually pure. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking that even in the mode of goodness, there needs to be some passion to remain in the mode of goodness.
Oh man, where'd you come up with that one?
Like, do we not have to be passionate to remain in the mode of goodness?
No. Oh, that speculative mind of yours is just indefatigable. No. The mode of goodness is sustained by Krishna. And that's not the mode of passion.
Maharaj, my question was, could you elaborate a little bit on offenses in devotee? It might be a big question.
Yeah, it's a big one. Those are the big questions you ask. They're not like
Maharaj, so what determines an offense in devotee association? Is it what the other person thinks about it? Or
what Krishna thinks about it?
But we don't know what Krishna thinks about.
Well, he gives us standards in scripture. So here's what Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says. If I'm engaged in some activity with a Vaishnava that's offensive towards that Vaishnava, but I think they're an advanced Vaishnava, surely they won't take it. Then, in addition to offending a Vaishnava, we're making an offense against the holy name of continuing a wrong activity on the strength that, well, it's okay because they're chanting and I'm chanting. Offense against them, it becomes a double offense.
I'm still not very clear about.
Okay. I don't know how we can make it clear. we try to avoid offenses. And what's the standard is, it's not, they may not have a problem. But what if, here's another way of saying the same thing. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur again says, while the devotee may be forgiving, Nama Prabhu may not. So when they go on chanting the holy name, but Nama Prabhu is absent. If from our side we're making an offense against the devotee. But the devotee, so again, the devotee, because your question was, does it depend on how the other person takes it? And the answer is no. It depends on how Krishna takes it. And you said, well, how do we know what Krishna, how Krishna takes it? From the statements of Scripture. That's our standard. Let's say Haridas Thakur. You know, Haridas Thakur was beaten in 21 marketplaces. From as far as Haridas Thakur was concerned, Hari Bol. As far as Nama Prabhu was concerned, it wasn't Hari Bol. It was an offense against Haridas Thakur. A grave offense. Spin that on that one for a while. It's not how the other person takes it alone. That's not a zero, but it's not everything either. Go ahead.
Right, so, in continuation, so, you said it in a very short way that it's an offense or not an offense based on what Krishna thinks of what you did.
Sure, that's the standard. That's what my point is. That's the standard of what is and what isn't.
Maharaj, so are there like specific things you can or you cannot do in a devotee association which will determine whether that action is an offense or not an offense? I mean, are there like specific shastras that we can refer to which tell us exactly what is an offense and what is not an offense?
Yeah, we have many scriptures. And they give us explanations. I don't know what you're doing. I'm lost.
Maharaj, my question is...
You want to know, is there a text that's the do nots in the Vaishnava Parad? It's not set aside like that. About, you know, let's say Srimad Bhagavatam. What Daksha did in relation to Lord Shiva was an offense. But it's not like, and that's just embedded in the Srimad Bhagavatam somewhere. It's not like there's one scripture that has compiled, that is not compartmentalized in that way. But our scriptures are filled with those understandings. You know, Mahabharata, Duryodhana. It's not like there's a section of Mahabharata, okay, these are the offenses committed in the Mahabharata, so you know to not do them. It's not compiled in that way. But your question was, are there scriptures that describe what are offenses against a devotee? The answer is it's filled in our scriptures. You know? One that's extracted at all. Now that's your text.
Thank you, Maharaj. Maharaj, then Hari Bhakti Vilas and Harinam Chintamani, there are lectures that you have given on that. So do they cover that aspect of...
Partially. In chapter 4, Harinam Chintamani, excuse me, Chapter 4 of Madhurya Kandavani describes the offenses against the holy, clearing the Anartha Nivritti section, and then through the chanting, there's goes through the offenses, and that's one of the offenses. And Harinam Chintamani goes through the offenses also. But that's not an exhaustive list. Oh. Okay.
Yeah. Whenever we are having friction with devotees, is it our past karma, or it's react to our past karma, or it's a test that Krishna gives? Because I'm like sort of confused. It's like Krishna taking completely the control of giving tests, or past karma also, you know, puts us in situations where we are tested.
It can be in many different things. It doesn't matter whether it's this one, that one, or the other one, or combination. Or say the same, I'll ask the same question in a different way. If you knew the answer, which one is the source of it, is that going to help you advance in Krishna consciousness? Let your say the same thing in a different way. Let those things that your attention goes to be those things that are going to directly help you advance in Krishna consciousness. The sanction of Krishna is ultimately behind everything. But it's not that if we were 100% pure devotees, if we were on the platform of Queen Kunti and the Pandavas, for example, and there was some test given to Queen Kunti and the Pandavas, then we know what it is. That's not us. But we're devotees, so it's not a zero either. Can I help?
Not that I have one more question.
Okay.
The thing that Shweta Madhuri was asking, it almost seems like a moment-to-moment thing. Like, you know, if you relax a little bit, you know, there is some proposition that Maya gives, and, you know, you sort of, it's almost like you have to be on your toes. If you relax a little bit, then you never know when, you know, some.
Okay, and therefore, stay on your toes. Become a ballerina. Is that alright?
Yeah, it just seems like, you know, does Krishna help you to be on their toes? Or?
Sure. He makes you have strong feet so you can stay on your toes. Prabhupada addressed this, and just make a short explanation. The way that a pure devotee stays always on guard against Maya is always praying to Krishna to please protect me against Maya. Krishna hears that sincere prayer. That is to say it the other way around. A pure devotee does not become complacent, thinking, oh, I'm a pure devotee, I can be complacent. There's no complacency in the consciousness of a pure devotee. They're respecting that Maya is very strong. So if it's true for Srila Prabhupada, certainly it's true for us. Maya is very strong. We should be very careful. And always praying to Krishna, please protect me from the onslaught of Maya. And that's one of the things that a pure devotee is known by. They have respect, even for Maya. And therefore they're very cautious. Okay, last question.
There is a particular tendency within me wherein it almost goes like this. I know that I'm fallen, but Prabhu, so are you. So how can I work on that?
Easy. You follow Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur's advice that says, look within and just do that. Your assignment is to make your heart pure. And unless the heart is pure, how can you be an asset to assist another person to make their heart pure? So the first business is make your, each of us make our hearts pure. You've probably heard me say this before many times, but I'll say it again. Ask yourself when you're in a situation like when you just say how your mind processes things. Instead, think, if Srila Prabhupada was in this situation, what would happen? Would the situation go up, go down, or stay the same? Answer, go up. What's the difference between my being in this situation and Prabhupada being in this situation? Answer, purity. So the problem's over here. There's not sufficient purity. So let me work on that. And then the situation will go up. Simple, huh? The life of devotion is we're seeking purity. And the more there's purity, we can be better instruments. Krishna will help things go up. We just get our impurity out of the way and things will go up. More and more and more and more and more. And you know, it's an ongoing years and years and years and, you know, purification work. And then just Krishna works with us to go further and become, you know, better instruments at elevating. It's wonderful. It doesn't stop. In other words, it's not like, okay, now I can just coast for a while. Reach a plateau and just kind of hang out for a while. Take it easy. It's an ever-growing Krishna consciousness is dynamic. So the challenge is not what's out there. The challenge is what's in here. Bring about purity inside, within. And then so many things can be met. What Prabhupada began with was a bunch of hippies with no place to stay. You know, he could, like, you know, invite some sannyasis to come and join the program and have kirtan while he was speaking to some, you know, he didn't have any resource. Nothing. Didn't have any money to go buy some groceries and cook a nice feast. He didn't have anything except purity. Well, it's Hari Vilas. You know who Hari Vilas is? Prabhupada disciple that is the president and the GBC in Seattle. Has established a very beautiful temple there. And he's very outspoken person. I mean, you can say it in other ways. He's our official contrarian.